What are the best and most useful insights from research into entrepreneurship? Vishal Gupta knows, because he's analyzed the winners of the Nobel Prize of Entrepreneurial Research.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are champions for customers, improving their lives with preferred products and services, value, and innovation. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. As you know, we're building a robust bridge from academic entrepreneurship research to applications, tools, and techniques for real entrepreneurs with real businesses, with real customers in real markets. We're on the research end of the bridge today. In fact, we're at the highest possible point of the bridge tower. Did you know there's a Nobel Prize for entrepreneurship research? That's what people call it anyway. It's the GAER, Global Award for Entrepreneurship Research. It's Swedish. The winner gets a medal and makes a prestigious presentation of her or his work, and it has all the trappings. More importantly for us, Professor Vishal Gupta has summarized all the research in a book he called Great Minds in Entrepreneurship Research, 30 or more years of research by the top professors in the field. We're going to hear about the findings and insights from Professor Gupta himself. Let me tease just a few of them to try to get you interested in ideas or analytics that can help you in business. First, the research reveals new ways to think about economic and business productivity. One that Professor Gupta suggests we look at is number of innovations per employee. Wow, that's a new idea. Research reveals that smaller size and more nimble entrepreneurial firms generate more innovations pro rata for their size than the big corporations like Apple. How do we do that? How do we do more of it? The same is true for business ratios like revenue per employee. The analysis prompts us to think bigger about what is possible. The research examines new firms and business models. In the podcast, you'll learn a new acronym, NTBF, or New Technology-Based Firms. More importantly, you'll learn that NTBFs can give birth to new business models, new ways of delivering dematerialized services, and new frontiers in customer relationships. Most important for me is the way that research is beginning at first to understand and then eventually to empower and unleash the role of imagination in business. Business schools try to make strategy a combination of math and logic, accessible only to those trained in business school. Entrepreneurship researchers recognize that opportunity is in the imaginative and creative mind of the individual. Enough from me. Let's listen to Vishal Gupta. He holds a PhD in business administration. He's a researcher in entrepreneurship, strategic management, and emerging markets. And he teaches those subjects at University of Alabama. Vishal, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Thank you, Hunter. Thanks for having me.
Well, you have written, Vishal, a wonderfully mind-opening book, it certainly opened my mind, about the best scientific research into the subject of entrepreneurship, which is our subject as well, obviously. You called the book Great Minds in Entrepreneurship Research, and you survey 30 or more years of research papers that are the best because they've won what some call, and you'll explain to us, the Nobel Prize of Entrepreneurship Research. So let's start there. Tell us about the prize and the organization behind it and the purpose.
Okay. So the reason it's sometimes called the Entrepreneurship Nobel or the Nobel Prize of Entrepreneurship Research, and I may add that's not its official name, is that it's a Sweden-based award like the Nobel Prize. It's a Swedish award. And like the Nobel Prize, you get a cash award and you get a statue with the award. And you're asked to do a prize lecture. Mm-hmm. So in all those aspects, it mimics the Nobel Prize. Where it departs from the Nobel Prize, of course, is that the award money is much less, and also that it's not part of the Nobel the Nobel Awards in general. Mm-hmm. In that sense, even economics is not officially, is not totally a part of the Nobel Prize, right? When Alfred Nobel left his will, he did not stipulate a prize for economics. That came later by the Swedish Central Bank. And the economics prize is technically the Swedish Central Bank Economic Science Award in memory of Alfred Nobel. But we call it, the Nobel Prize. And if you go to the Nobel Prize website, it lists the economics prize. The Swedish Central Bank was asked if they would be interested in sponsoring a prize for entrepreneurship research, and they refused. And, in entrepreneurship, we say, luck, serendipity plays a big role. And the same thing you could say about the award, which is the newspaper, one of the Swedish newspapers talked about how the Swedish Central Bank said no to sponsoring the award. And it was picked up by a senior manager of a Swedish telecom company, Telia, T-E-L-I-A, and they said, we will help sponsor it. So they partnered with Swedish Agency for Economic and Regional Growth and the Swedish Foundation for Small Business Research. And together, they came up with the idea of this award. And I discuss it in the first chapter of the book. Mm-hmm.
Good. So that's great background. Thank you. And we're going to work our way through some aspects of the book today. I think it's full of gems. It's a very rich cornucopia. You've organized it in a very interesting way, I think, gathering some of the many, many papers together in similar groups. I didn't quite know where to start, so I thought that maybe one place to start is the definition of entrepreneurship, which is quite difficult. Maybe it's a young science, and we haven't got quite to the precise definition yet. And I picked a phrase from your conclusion, Vishal. You said, we're still in the time of theoretical pluralism and eclecticism. So tell us what you were thinking there and how that impinges on the definition of entrepreneurship.
So when we look at entrepreneurship research, the reason I talk about theoretical pluralism and eclecticism is there's two reasons. One is the definition. There's literally scores of definition of entrepreneurship, what entrepreneurship means, especially from a research perspective. You see, if I was to talk to a person on the street and I said, what does entrepreneurship mean to you? They would most likely say starting a new business. And in my discussions with students, for example, that take entrepreneurship courses with us, that's kind of what they have in mind as to the definition of entrepreneurship. But as researchers, our job is to shoot for accuracy and to try to come up with a precise definition. And so in attempts to do so, what we found is that the nature of entrepreneurship is so broad, and people understand entrepreneurial activity in so many different ways, sometimes without even realizing that they have this multifaceted understanding of entrepreneurship, that really there is no definition on which scholars agree in terms of entrepreneurship. So there's several definitions of entrepreneurship, and some of the awardees, some of the laureates, have also tried to offer definitions of entrepreneurship, none of which has been universally embraced by the whole field.
One of the themes that I thought I picked up going through it was the idea of new entry. There's one of the statements in the book, the essential act of entrepreneurship is new entry, and the author meant entering new or established markets with new or existing goods, launching a new venture. It included internal corporate venturing. So new entry was perhaps one they could agree on as characteristic of entrepreneurship. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is accurate in the sense that new entry is a popular understanding of entrepreneurship. People frequently think of new entry as what entrepreneurship is, but like with any other definition, it leaves out a whole lot of things. For example, when you look at the definition, when you look at what's meant by new entry, it doesn't encompass, for example, family firms. It wouldn't cover a family firm that, let's say, I was to take over unless I engaged in the act of new entry via that firm. Mm-hmm. And so I think new entry is a common way that the field understands entrepreneurship, but again, it's not the whole thing.
Yeah. So one of the things that I found helpful was that there was a separation by these researchers from the idea of business size. So they separated small business from entrepreneurship, which I think is helpful. And they also covered corporate entrepreneurship, which includes new entry, which we just talked about, and innovation executed by corporations. So they certainly separated size from entrepreneurship as a function or a role.
That is correct. And to someone like me who immersed himself in sort of the history of entrepreneurship research and the discipline, this separation of entrepreneurship from small business in the literature was very interesting, especially because if you look at the early days of entrepreneurship research, it was people who were interested in small businesses that really got the field started. It was entrepreneurship was considered almost synonymous with small business in the early days of the field. And so it's interesting that over time, large parts of the field have tried to, separate between entrepreneurship and small business. And one of the reasons is these scholars argue that entrepreneurship can also happen in large corporations, which, as you brought up and we discuss in the book, is corporate entrepreneurship. And there have been several awardees who've received the award for working in the area of corporate entrepreneurship or the overlap of entrepreneurship with strategy in terms of large firms. So I think what has happened over time is that the definition of entrepreneurship has broadened. Even though it started with small businesses, it has broadened. And the other thing that has happened is this cleavage in the field between people who are interested primarily in small businesses and people who are interested in, entrepreneurship outside of small businesses. And I'll give you an example. If you look at the Journal of Small Business Management, it's one of the top seven entrepreneurship journals, and small business is in its name. So, the journal likes to focus on entrepreneurial phenomenon that happens in the context of small businesses. But if you look at Journal of Business Venturing, one of the things I realized in kind of doing the research for this book is, over time, they've become less and less interested in small businesses, and they want to focus squarely on entrepreneurship that is not hinged or tightly coupled with small businesses. So that's how the field is sort of evolving.
Yeah. And then another way of looking at entrepreneurship and of studying it and researching it is in terms of what I would call contribution. So how it contributes to the economy and to growth and so on. One common way of looking at that is job creation. That seems to be a special focus, Vishal.
That is correct, Hunter. And that has always been the focus of entrepreneurship, for good and for bad. In that sense, entrepreneurship is pretty unique as an academic field, right? If you were to look at marketing or accounting or, finance, the responsibility of job creation, you don't see that in any other field. But somehow entrepreneurship, for good and or for bad, is closely associated with job creation. And that's been prominent from the beginning. I talk in the book about the work of David Birch, who was squarely who spent a lot of time investigating this idea of job creation. So, that is correct.
Yeah. But then there's a whole area in the book and in the research about a much broader definition of contribution of entrepreneurship to economic growth. You mentioned Schumpeterian kind of growth. You might want to explain that a little bit more. But another term I saw, as well as the Schumpeterian idea, was economic productivity, which that seemed like a new way of looking at entrepreneurship. And there were some metrics there which are really different, I think. Number of innovations per employee and the amount of money spent per new technological innovation. And it was more efficient in a small company than a big one, perhaps. So that's a whole other area, looking at growth and innovation. Vishal, tell us about that.
Yeah, so Hunter, what you see in entrepreneurship is this interesting idea that entrepreneurship should contribute to economic development, economic growth. And I find that fascinating because, again, you know, if you look at sociology or if you look at finance, no one has this responsibility of economic growth. And with entrepreneurship, we want to be able to say, to be able to show that entrepreneurship leads to economic growth. And I think that's where a lot of interesting research happens, like finding the link between entrepreneurial activity and economic growth. And I talk about, you know, some of that research in the book. Now, when you start looking at economic growth, economic development, economic productivity, you get into some really fascinating territory. For example, we find that large businesses create lots of innovations, okay? But in some sense, you would expect that given that they have more employees and more money. And so is the correct metric of measurement number of innovations, or should it be scaled by number of employees and number of, you know, the amount of money it takes to bring something to the market? And I think that's where you see scholars grappling with this question of what is the proper way to measure these things. If you look at the popular media, the journalists, my sense is they don't have to grapple with this question in the same way that scholars have to grapple with. And that's because, you know, we are very concerned with accuracy of our measurement. And so you find that the field has sort of moved towards, the field has sort of made attempts to move towards a finer grained measure of economic productivity than just innovation or, you know, any other absolute measure like that.
A quick note, did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's MISES.org/E4EPod, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the term economic productivity, Vishal, because that got me thinking that it's not the kind of financial results by which, as you say, journalists and others tend to judge companies, but the efficient use of resources in producing innovation and producing growth for less money or with fewer employees. So that seemed like a breakthrough kind of a metric. I hadn't seen that before.
Yeah, I think you put it very well. Efficient use of resources is what economic productivity is getting to, right? And, you know, without getting too far from, you know, from the scope of this book, I mean, there are many fields in this country where we are not making efficient use of resources, right? Healthcare comes to mind, education comes to mind. where we are making investments that are very, very high compared to the rest of the OECD countries. And yet the output we have to show for all the input is much less. And so I think that's where economic productivity comes in, is how can we make sure that the output is sort of commensurate with the input.
Right. Right. So that's a whole area of analysis that's very promising here. I also found this other acronym in there, Vishal, NTBF, New Technology-Based Firm. And it's nice to be thinking about new ways of defining entrepreneurial businesses. And I wondered whether, firstly, I wondered what it meant. Could that be somebody starting a storefront on Amazon because that's a new technology? Or does it have to be like a Google introducing a new search engine? Just unpack new technology-based firms for a little bit.
Yeah, so it's interesting you picked up on that, because Arnie Cooper, who's one of the awardees we discussed in the book, first talked about it in the context of the 1970s. And of course, if you remember, that was the time you had sort of the early days of the computer industry, right? I mean, you had firms like Apple being founded in the mid-70s and so on and so forth. So that's what he was referring to when he first came up with this idea of technology-based firms, is firms that emphasize technology as part of their operations and strategy much more deeply than was the case at the time. So that's how it started. And so a new technology-based firm would mean sort of like, you know, if somebody was starting a Google today or an Apple today, right, that would be a new technology-based firm. It could be software, it could be hardware. Back then, it was, as you know, mostly hardware. The idea that software was a place to make money in really started with, you know, the famous story about Bill Gates, Microsoft, and IBM, right? Mm-hmm. Where Bill Gates wanted the ability to sell the software to other firms when he was selling it to IBM. And that's a popular story, right? And IBM said, well, there's no money in software. Sure, you can sell it to whoever you want. And we know how that turned out. But I think today the term new technology-based firm would be used for both hardware and software firms. I think that's been true for the last two decades or so. Yeah, I think this area hasn't received as much attention as it should have. I teach entrepreneurship, and I don't see NTBFs mentioned a lot in entrepreneurship textbooks. So I think you were right in identifying this as something that one doesn't see very often, but I think one should see it more often.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds like a fascinating focus of study that we could make for the current era.
Especially, Hunter, if I may, one of the things I think that makes this a really important area of study going forward, NTBFs, is notice how technology allows us to grow as a firm and become much larger without hiring as many people as a large firm was supposed to do in mm-hmm. the past. So if you look at a firm today that's, you know, X hundred million dollars in revenue, and you compare it to 50 years ago, a similar firm that was X hundred million dollars in revenue, one of the big things you will find, and although I don't think there's any research on this, is the number of employees and how the number of employees today in to reach that level of large firm or successful firm is much less than it was the case in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, revenue per employee is one measure of that. And, you know, software companies are in the millions of dollars per employee sometimes. So it's a, yeah. You're right, it's a whole new ratio.
And it's the technology that allows companies to do that, right? They can, you know, they don't need as many employees because much of what they're selling is online.
Yeah, and it also, it changes the economy at the customer end too. The definition of service, for example, becomes wholly different when you're a technology-based company. You're online. You've digitized and dematerialized everything. Service used to be defined as people doing things for people. Now it's defined in a different way. It's a digitized service.
It is. And, you know, one of the interesting examples I found is, for example, the famous company Warby Parker. I'm assuming you've heard about them.
Yes, yeah, the online spectacles.
Online glasses. And in the early days, it's funny because their founders say that when they first launched the company and people wanted to come look at the spectacles, because, you know, that was the model we were all used to.
Mm-hmm.
People would say, well, I want to buy, but I want to look at them. They would have to say, you can come look, but you'll have to come to my apartment. And people would be surprised because they thought this was going to be like a highly, you know, like a successful company of the past, right? Where you have a big facility, where you have lots of displays. And the founders tell the story of how people would come and they would have the spectacles on the dining table. And people would come and look at it on their dining table in the apartment. And and you know, without technology, that just wouldn't have been possible.
There was another way that your research summaries captured one of the areas of focus, and that is on dynamics. That these entrepreneurial businesses bring a lot of dynamics to the economy in a positive way. A lot of it was captured in life cycle, a birth, growth, maturity, death kind of summary, which is, I don't know, not a way that I would look at things. But the whole idea of the product life cycle, that there is a beginning, a middle, and an end to everything, and the dynamics are keeping that going, knowing when to start another cycle. Tell us about that.
So the product life cycle is a really popular framework that economists and especially marketing folks use. And this idea is that industries or companies, you know, they birth, they grow, they become mature, and then they die, right? That's sort of the life cycle, right? And so that's been a popular framework in economics and marketing. But one of the things that I learned as I researched in this book is that this biological metaphor, if you will, of the life cycle doesn't translate really fully into business. Because of entrepreneurship, you can sort of, how do I say this? You can avoid maturity. You can avoid death, where in the biological world, that is just not possible. So, you know, a firm can, you know, do things in a way that it delays maturity more and more, and that it delays death way more than, you know, it would be possible in the biological world. My favorite example, if you will, of something like this is, you know, Steve Jobs and Apple, right? Which is Steve Jobs as a human being had a life cycle, right? I mean, he went through maturity and he's, you know, died sadly too early. But the company he founded, you know, they were able to sort of avoid death, if you will, in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was able to sort of bring them back from dead in the early 2000s. And then, you know, with his whole approach to introducing new products, he was able to avoid them becoming sort of like a mature company, kept them young, if you will, by, you know, introducing first the iPod, then the iPad, and then, you know, iPod, iPhone, and then the iPad. That's just not possible in the biological world. So I think economists like the life cycle approach because it gives them sort of like a good framework with which to study companies and industries. But in the real world, you do see that in business, you can avoid maturity and death.
Yeah.
Can I give you an example if it's okay with you?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So if you look at, for example, the computer industry, right? Many people were talking about how the personal computer industry in the US is mature. There's no growth, right? And that was true for the longest time. And then COVID hit, right? So guess what happened? Laptops and desktops and other computing devices, the sales increased. So in that sense, you know, the industry sort of, you know, didn't go the route the product lifecycle would say, but it saw sort of almost like a rebirth, if you will. And again, that's just not possible in the biological world.
Yeah, so maybe this idea of PLC, the product lifecycle, should be dumped. I mean, another way to look at what you just described is the new science of complex adaptive systems, where there's constant change and constant growth and constant adaptation. You try desperately to avoid extinction, which is what the death part of the PLC is, and you're looking for when to explore new areas as opposed to exploit the area you've already been in. So maybe dynamic adaptive systems is a better way to look at it than a life cycle.
So, Hunter, I was first exposed to the idea of complex adaptive systems in my PhD program. And even as I was doing my PhD, the whole concept of complex adaptive systems took me time to grasp. The thing with product lifecycle or, you know, any lifecycle-based concept is it's so easy to grasp, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it has survived and it continues to be a popular tool popular framework discussed in textbooks, is because of how intuitive and easy it is to understand. And complex adaptive systems, even though it may be closer to reality, is more difficult to grasp. And so we just like water goes the path of the least resistance, I think when it comes to learning about business, we also take the path of sort of the simplest concept. Yeah. And we go with the path that offers us the simplest framework.
Yeah. Interestingly, if I've got this right, Vishal, complex adaptive systems theory recognizes that there are often inferior ideas or products or services that can become very popular because they're easy. And I think one of the examples they quote is the QWERTY keyboard layout versus the Vorak or Vojak, however you pronounce it, which it's not the better one, but it's the one that everyone is used to, so they stick with it.
That is correct. That is correct. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you could see that in many places, right? One of my professors from the PhD program, and I'll, you know, give a shout out to him, he wrote a book on the concept of time, Alan Bloudon. And in the book, he discusses all the research on daylight saving time and how, you know, the concept has outgrown its usefulness, if you will, and in terms of expense and everything else, that we should no longer have two shifts in time every year, and yet we persist with it. So, yeah. So I think that's the beauty, if you will, of you know, things is we gravitate to what is known, what is simpler, what is easier, and we like to stick with it.
Well, let me focus on one more area in your book, Vishal, that caught my eye, and that was the role of knowledge in entrepreneurship research. And, you know, as Austrian economists, we're familiar with Hayek and his idea of dispersed knowledge or distributed knowledge. I like Jesus Huerta de Soto's theories of entrepreneurship as knowledge creation, new knowledge creation. But there were different areas of knowledge focus in your research: knowledge transfer, knowledge sharing, knowledge absorption, and knowledge conversion. And those were about the productivity of knowledge, I think. Please talk to us about what the research says about those elements of knowledge in the economic function.
So one of the GAER awardees I discussed in the book is Shak Azara, and he has done a lot of work on absorptive capacity and the idea that different firms have sort of different acceptance of new knowledge. And that acceptance of new knowledge from those firms is sort of path dependent. You know, what they know and how they know it influences sort of what new things they can learn. You could say that's similar to how we would think about knowledge absorption at the individual level, right? Or how much our students learn in college or universities depends on what they know in the past and, you know, where they stand with regard to that. So Shaka Zara has done a lot of work in that area and has some of the most well-cited papers there. And that's what I was talking about, which is this idea that, you know, this, as Hayek also brought up, that, you know, knowledge is distributed and different people have different pieces of the knowledge. But the idea of absorptive capacity is, even when you're exposed to new knowledge, what you can absorb from that varies based on what you already know. And so that's what I was talking about.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting examples of knowledge transfer that was in there was somebody who's been working at a big company, let's say, you know, Hewlett-Packard, just to pick one, for 20 years, but they leave and they do a startup. They start their own venture. And there's a knowledge transfer there. They're bringing thoughts and ideas and techniques and so on that they've learned, but they're reapplying it in a new, more dynamic, more growth-oriented, perhaps more innovative kind of a way. So that was an interesting example of knowledge transfer. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but that's another entrepreneurial use of knowledge.
That is correct. And, you know, it's interesting you bring up HP and you know, entrepreneurship, because we all know the famous story of how Steve Wozniak, you know, when he came up with the idea of the personal computer, right, he didn't really want to start a new business. He thought he owed it to, you know, HP. And he said, you know, here's what I've done. And, you know, why don't you guys take it? And they were like, no, we don't want it. And he was like, yeah, but I did it, you know, when I was working for you and it was on company time. And, you know, I used what I learned in this company to come up with this. And they were like, yeah, but we don't really want it. So, you know, and he said, well, then you leave me no other option but to start my own business. And they were like, sure, good luck. And yeah, we know how that went.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, good knowledge transfer in that case. So we tend to think about entrepreneurship, at least I do, a lot as an economic phenomenon. One of the things you pointed out in the book, Vishal, is that there's work in other disciplines in the analysis and study of entrepreneurship. You talked about the interdisciplinary study, and you included sociology and finance, management, other disciplines. That's a whole interesting area of looking at entrepreneurship through different lenses. So expand on that for us a little bit, please.
So Hunter, most people do think of entrepreneurship as an economic phenomenon. And I, you know, in many ways, I was guilty of that too. I thought of it as an economic and a psychological phenomenon. But one of the things that became very obvious to me as I researched for this book is how much of entrepreneurship research is taking place in fields that we don't usually look at: sociology, finance, religion, and I could anthropology, and so on and so forth. So I think it's sort of beautiful how entrepreneurship is so interdisciplinary that so many people in different fields are studying it. The problem is, as Hayek said, right, when knowledge is distributed, it becomes very difficult for any one person to have, it is impossible for any one person to have all of it. And so that's, I think, the challenge in entrepreneurship today is there's pieces of knowledge about entrepreneurship that exist in different disciplines. And because it's so distributed, you're not going to have a unified theory of entrepreneurship or one common understanding of entrepreneurship.
Maybe you could pull it together for us in your next book, Vishal.
Well, one of the things, I think a lot of people in entrepreneurship would like that, like, you know, attempts to pull it together. But anytime we try to pull together all that distributed knowledge, I think we'll have to simplify it a lot And in doing that, you lose richness and complexity of entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm going to see if I can draw you into a controversy now, Vishal. There was a section in your summary of the research that talked about the individual opportunity nexus, i.e. between the individual and the opportunity, that not everyone is likely to recognize the same opportunities, whether they're technological or otherwise. And it seemed to be talking about opportunities as an objective phenomenon. And your and my good friend Peter Klein and his co-author Nikolai Foss emphasized to us that opportunities are subjectively imagined by entrepreneurs. They don't exist objectively. So have I found a controversy there in the research?
You have, sir. You have found a controversy. There is a big debate in entrepreneurship research on whether opportunities are objective or subjective. One of the awardees that I discussed in the book is Scott Shane, and he is famously talked about how entrepreneurship opportunities exist objectively. And as you rightly pointed out, that Peter Klein, Nikolai Foss, and some of us, I have a 2007 paper where we talk about opportunities, the subjectivity of opportunities. We believe that opportunities do not exist objectively outside of, you know, sort of the individual or the team that recognizes, that creates that opportunity. And I think there's a big debate in the entrepreneurship literature about this. I think people who hew closer to sort of the neoclassical framework, like Scott Shane, as I discussed in the book, seem to be more in line with opportunities existing objectively. Another GAER awardee, another awardee of the Entrepreneurship Nobel, was Israel Kirzner, the famous Austrian scholar. And he too believed that opportunities exist objectively. I think that is sort of the starting point for this debate between Israel Kirzner, one Austrian, and Ludwig Lachmann, another Austrian, who believed that opportunities were subjective and do not exist objectively, independent of the entrepreneur.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm a layman in this, and I'm not qualified, but I do get fascinated by looking at that. It seems to be aligned with the whole theory of value that's created more by the customer. There's a lot of thinking in that direction these days than by the firm. The firms just facilitate it. So that would seem to me to be in the same direction as subjective opportunities as opposed to objective opportunities. So everything's moving in some interesting directions, Vishal.
Yeah, so there is, you know, as you said, there's the idea of value. There's also the idea of knowledge. And there's also the idea of sort of imagination or expectations, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, two people, no matter how alike they are not going to have exactly the same knowledge or exactly the same expectations for the future. So if you and I were to walk through downtown Tuscaloosa, let's say, you know, I think people who believe in objective opportunities would argue that you and I would have the same views on whether downtown Tuscaloosa needs another pizza place or another, you know, Italian restaurant. And I think people who believe in subjective opportunities would argue that you and I could walk through downtown Tuscaloosa and think of different ways in which one of us could sell pizza or Italian food that the other has not thought of ever. And I think that's how I see the difference between objective and subjective opportunity.
Yeah, that's a good summary. Well, let's see if we can close with some kind of a summation. Vishal, I'm going to revisit your phrase, theoretical pluralism and eclecticism, and see if in that context you can give us some maybe general conclusions about this entrepreneurial research. Maybe that's not possible, but some kind of conclusion about where the research is today and maybe where you think it might go tomorrow, so we can anticipate some of the future prizes.
So I think the research is thriving, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. I came into this field about 20 years ago, early 2000s. And, you know, in the book, I talk about how one of the senior scholars who was awarded this the Global Award for Entrepreneurship Research says that in the 1990s, all that we knew about entrepreneurship research, you could pretty much read in a couple of months, and you could put it together in sort of one or two or three volumes, and you would have sort of the whole knowledge that existed about entrepreneurship for the most part. Today, that's impossible, as we've discussed a few minutes back. Today, that knowledge is beyond the comprehension of any one or two or five or 10 scholars. And so I think the field has thrived, field has grown, field has flourished a lot in the last two decades. I expect that blossoming and that flourishing to continue going forward. In terms of, you know, where I see some of the interesting things happening is, I think one of the chapters in the book, we talk about geography. So I hope that there's more research in terms of the geography of entrepreneurship, understanding entrepreneurial clusters, whether it's Silicon Valley or whether it's the clusters in Italy or the clusters in, you know, France, understanding clusters or geography. I also think that there is something to be said about how entrepreneurship research needs to interact more with, for example, healthcare and education, and see if we can sort of do something in the space where we leverage what we've learned from entrepreneurship to improve healthcare, education, and some of the fields that have sort of not seen the kind of entrepreneurial activity that we would have liked them to see.
Right. Yes, devoutly to be wished. And we are seeing some early movement in that direction, I think. That's a positive development. So, Vishal, you've written this wonderful book. I recommend it to everybody. It's a fantastic source of knowledge. There's an ebook available. We'll link to it. There's not only the summaries of these decades of research and the trends and the knowledge there, but the references and the footnotes are really, really rich. So it allows you to browse and find some new directions and new papers you didn't know about and new readings. It's just absolutely immersive, I found. So I know it was a lot of hard work and took a long time, but we certainly thank you for it. And thanks for your analysis today. This has been really tremendously insightful. Thank you.
Thank you, Hunter. I totally enjoyed my discussion with you today, and thank you for the probing questions. The book took me 2 years to write, so it was sort of, you know, a labor of love, if you will. But I learned a lot in writing the book, and I hope that the readers and the listeners of this podcast will, if they read the book, they'll also learn as much as I learned from the rich entrepreneurship research that we have out there.
Yeah, well, anybody who does read it, I certainly recommend it. You'll learn a ton. So it's a great use of your learning time. And Vishal, maybe we can have you come back and we'll talk about complex adaptive systems in economics.
Thank you, Hunter. I appreciate that. And I would love to have another discussion.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.